This past October, we spoke with neuroscientist Sandra Ahmed, the former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience, and Sam Wong, associate professor of neuroscience at Princeton University, about how a child's brain develops during the first years of life. We've invited them back for this week's Please Explain to further the story and discuss brain development in older children and teenagers, from learning to behavioral issues, mood disorders, and the effect of hormonal changes. Doctors Ahmed and Wong are the co-authors of Welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Conception to College. It's published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased to welcome them back to our show. Hello.
Thanks for having us back.
Yes, a pleasure.
Sandra, one of the topics we didn't talk about last time is gender, and boys and girls seem to differentiate themselves fairly soon as they get older. When did children first begin to even identify with their sex?
A child who's 2 years old is reasonably precocious if he or she can tell you, I'm a girl or I'm a boy. By three, all kids have it. On average, it's about age 2.5.
Well, we are told that male and female brains are different. Are they different from the start, or is this part of the development in those years?
They are different from the start, and then there's a lot of socialization that's laid on over top of that. In very young kids, you see the most dramatic gender differences that you will ever see in all of life. And I've always sort of interpreted that as the same kind of over-regularization that you see in kids who are learning language. You know, every past tense ends in ED, every plural ends in S. And I think that all this pink frilly ballerina dresses and
boys
really
playing
rough,
with guns,
really rough play in boys, is that same kind of thing. You know, they've got a sort of rough idea of what it means to be a boy or what it means to be a girl, but they don't have a lot of nuance yet. They just have this sort of cartoon outline in their minds of what that means.
So, Sam, there are a lot of stereotypes and assumptions about girl and boy behavior. You've evaluated many of those studies on sex differences. What kinds of patterns have you noticed?
Well, as Sandra says, there is self-identification, but early in life there are also things like toy preferences. So, again, going all the way back to age 3, boys and girls have powerful preferences as to what kind of toys they will play with. And so, for instance, a boy typical toy, like a truck or a tool, will be preferred by an average boy more than 97% of girls. And the converse is true of T-sets. And so many of these things are learned, but they're also built-in things that we can see in humans, in monkeys, too.
But if a boy likes to play with dolls, some parents freak out, although there's probably no reason to. But is that an indicator of any future behavior?
That's interesting because it's different for boys and girls. And that probably reflects, as a society, how comfortable we are with girls acting like boys. A girl who acts like a boy, there's absolutely no predictive value for sexual orientation at all.
We just say she was a tomboy when
yeah,
she was young.
There's lots and lots of tomboys, and most of them grow up to be straight. There are many fewer little boys who like to play with dolls and persist in that behavior despite the disapproval that they get for it. And among those boys, something on the order of half will turn out to be gay, and half won't. So you can't really tell.
Well, how can we separate learned behavior from innate behavior when it comes to things like that?
You really can't entirely. But, for instance, sex differences that we see in other animals are more likely to have a biological basis. Almost nothing in humans is purely biological. We layer culture on over everything we do.
Sam, can you talk about behavioral differences between the sexes? Are boys usually more aggressive and active than girls?
Well, let's see. So as I was saying before, boys certainly have a strong preference for what one might call manipulanda, things that you can push around, manipulate. And it's true for human boys, monkey boys. There are other differences, too, but they're smaller. So, for instance, boys from early childhood are more active and are more aggressive. But those are smaller differences. They're a little bit more active and aggressive than girls. Girls are a little bit more able to concentrate and engage in fine motor coordination. But the differences are maybe a third, a quarter the size of the toy preference.
Now, girls, especially when they get into adolescence, seem to be more mature and socialized than boys. Are the brains of girls more developed at an earlier age?
They are. By the time girls are 12 or 13, their brain development, depending on what area of the brain you're talking about, is somewhere between 1 and 3 years ahead of the boy's brain development at the same age. And then by the end of the teenage years, they've all caught up.
I've had female friends who've told me males never catch up.
I think that's exceedingly harsh.
I think we do all right.
I took it personally. Sandra Ahmed is a neuroscientist and former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience. Sam Wong is associate professor of neuroscience at Princeton University. And we are talking about the development of brains in children into their teenage years. We invite your calls here at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It's Please Explain. Do the differences in those early years affect how boys and girls learn, Sandra?
They do, and it's mostly the difference Sam mentioned a minute ago, that girls are better at sitting still and concentrating when they enter school, and that gives them a big advantage in the early school years. They would, on average, be much more likely to listen to what the teacher says and complete their assignments, and, you know, teachers like that.
Well, Sam, some people argue that same-sex schools are better environments for children to learn in. Is this an argument for that?
Well, it's possible that same-sex schools are perhaps easier for the teacher because they have a more homogenous group of students to deal with. If everyone is able to pay attention to the same extent, then there's a little bit of an easier time for the teacher. But Sandra, I don't remember evidence that same-sex teaching is more effective. Do you?
No, I think actually same-sex teaching is likely to be more of a problem for boys because we already know, as we talked about the last time we were on the show, that children learn social behavior from the better behaved children in their class. So if you take all the girls out and just let the boys learn from each other, that doesn't seem like such a good idea.
Are there certain subjects that one sex is better at learning than the other?
Girls are Go ahead.
Well, there are some things that boys and girls do show some differences at. So, for instance, girls are better at remembering where something is, spatial memory. And boys are better at mentally rotating an object, for instance, seeing what something's going to be like if you look at it from the other side. And so those are things that seem to be pretty well wired in.
Are there differences in the self-esteem and confidence levels between boys and girls?
Those develop later. In the early teenage years, there's a big sex difference. It's big now. It's 40 years ago, it was a small sex difference, and now it's a big sex difference, which gives you some sense that it's partly cultural in terms of body image between girls and boys. That girls are much more likely in their early teen years to be unhappy with their bodies and feel less confident about how attractive their bodies are than boys.
Is that because, it seems reasonable, girls' bodies change a lot more as they reach puberty than boys do?
No, I think boys change a fair bit, too. It's actually been linked in some studies, the change in girls, to this thin ideal that they see in fashion magazines. Girls who read more celebrity and fashion magazines are much more likely to feel bad about their bodies than girls who don't.
Are there ways that parents can encourage a healthy body image in their children?
Yeah, very much so. Parents who give their girl children a hard time about their weight, who tease them about their bodies, are not only putting their children at higher risk of developing an eating disorder, which seems like the obvious thing that you'd expect to come from that, but ironically, those kids in longitudinal studies, those daughters, are also at higher risk of becoming obese 5 years later.
Sam, children seem to stick with friends of the same sex through elementary school, but then start socializing in mixed groups when they're adolescents. Is this influenced by hormones?
It probably is influenced by hormones. Puberty, occurring sometime between, I guess, age 11 and 13, is a time when hormones start acting on the brain. Hormones act on the developing brain both before birth, in a burst of activity that differentiates boy from girl brains, which accounts for a lot of the things we talked about. And then there's another burst of remodeling that happens around puberty. There's this constant churn of synapses and connections, and certain aspects of it are accelerated by estrogen and testosterone as kids enter their teen years.
And is it sudden? Many parents say that it's like their child changes overnight when they hit puberty.
Well, overnight. I mean, the thing is, puberty takes something like a year to manifest, and so it's certainly possible that parents suddenly notice. They look up one day and the kid becomes surly or rebellious or what have you.
And are they learning in a different way during this time than they did when they were young?
So the one thing that differentiates the teenage brain from the brains of children and adults, the one way that teenagers are just entirely different from every other stage of life, is that they are, especially boy children, especially right after puberty, they are much more sensitive to novelty and reward values than they ever have been or ever will be again. And what that means in practice is that they're much more drawn to approaching uncertain situations, to see whether something good might come out of this, to see whether they can learn something or experience something interesting. That will affect learning a lot, because a lot of learning in humans is reward-driven.
And you're saying that this adolescent risk-taking and impulsiveness is more common in boys than girls?
It's more hormone-driven in boys. So in girls, it's not specifically timed to puberty. Girls typically go through it, but it's a little more unpredictable when they're going to go through it. But a boy who has just gone through puberty, on average, has the highest scores for novelty-seeking that of any other group in the human lifespan.
Listeners have been writing in. A listener asks, getting back to a question we dealt with earlier, are boys as sensitive about their body image? Are they as susceptible to eating disorders?
Not yet.
You're saying not yet? You see a growing trend?
There is a growing trend. Their body image is getting worse in both boys and girls since about the 70s. But right now, you have something on the order of one boy with an eating disorder for every 10 girls.
Although we keep on hearing about childhood obesity, and that would apply to both boys and girls, wouldn't it?
Yes. It's a little more prevalent in girls, but it's not as big a difference as the difference in eating disorders.
Catherine from Manhattan asks, young people who have gender identities that are different from their biological assignation, how does this manifest itself in childhood? Sam?
Well, so Catherine is asking about self-identification with gender as being different from the anatomical gender?
I think that what she's saying is if a boy realizes a really young age. Actually, I'm going to go to the caller. Why should I speak for her? She's on the line. Hi, Catherine.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Catherine.
Catherine, yeah, can you clarify your question?
Well, I was listening earlier. I had to miss some of the segment because I was on with your screener. But they were talking about boys and girls, how they test differently. And I kept wondering to myself, does a girl who identifies herself as a boy, that we would identify her as a girl, but she would self-identify as a boy, does she tend to test as a girl? Maybe it hasn't been documented, but so if transgender people, do they tend to test along the lines of their physical gender or their psychological gender?
An interesting question.
I've heard some anecdotal evidence suggesting that people who turn out to be transgender behave more like the sex that they eventually become than like the sex they were assigned at birth as children, but I'm not aware of any systematic studies on it. It's a pretty small population of people, and in order to do those kinds of studies correctly, you really have to catch the children as children and test them and then follow them through to adulthood, which is really challenging since they're pretty rare in the population.
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more of this Please Explain look at the development of children's brains into adolescence with the authors of Welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Conception to College. It's published by Bloomsbury, and its authors are Sandra Amat, a neuroscientist, former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience, and Sam Wong, associate professor of neuroscience at Princeton University. We're inviting your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back to today's Please Explain look at how children's brains develop with the authors of Welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Conception to College. It's published by Bloomsbury, and its authors are Sam Wong, associate professor of neuroscience at Princeton University, and Sandra Amat, a neuroscientist, former editor-in-chief of Nature Neuroscience. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Before we get to those calls, a few questions that a number of people have asked about. One of them has to do with bullying and cyberbullying among teenagers, something we've been hearing a lot about in the news. Can you offer any explanation for what makes some teenagers so mean?
Well, that's an interesting one. Cyberbullying is unique because it's something that happens at a distance. So survey data from the Pew Center have shown that empathy scores have gone down in the last 5-10 years. Responses to things like, before I do or say something, do I take into account how the other person is going to feel?
And do they explain that because kids spend so much time on computers and they have that distance?
It's not known, but it coincides with the advent of electronic communication, text messaging, modes of messaging in which you're able to have social contact without paying any of the negative consequences. And so it's possible to get the social reward, and then the negative consequences get dissociated from that. It's not demonstrated what's been behind the empathy decrease, but it is a coincidence. Maybe it's an interesting coincidence that it's gone with increased electronic communication.
Are the kinds of friends that we have as teenagers a good indication of our behavior even later in life?
The friends that you have as a child or a teenager not only are selected to be somewhat similar to you in the first place, but you also will become more similar to them as the friendship develops. So if you look at the progress of friendships over years, you see that in both good and bad ways, kids tend to become more similar to their friends. They are more likely to take academics seriously. If their friends take academics seriously, they're more likely to be mean if their friends are mean.
A listener asks about how much changes in the brain during adolescence. Do skills like our eye-hand coordination get honed then?
Well, the brain is, in some respects, almost complete, at least in size, by the beginning of adolescence. By late childhood, it's close to 10% of its final size in all sorts of ways. But obviously, adolescents are increasing in their coordination. One thing that adolescents do that perhaps improves those things is practice through play. And in modern times, through playing video games, for instance, they can improve their reaction times and hand-eye coordination.
Let's take a call from Andrea. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
My question was, I believe I read, it might have been in the New York Times Magazine, about adolescent brain development and impulse control and consequences connected to those decisions, those actions that they choose to take that may affect their lives, you know, the rest of their lives. And I believe that I read that impulse control and connection to consequences is not fully formed until 25 years of age. Did I understand that correctly?
You mostly understood it correctly. Impulse control gets better all the way through from about 2 years of age and doesn't get to fully adult levels until 25. The curious thing about teenagers, though, is that if you ask a 16-year-old to talk to you about a risk, how likely is it? What bad things could happen? What are the odds that the bad thing might happen? What would be the consequences if the bad thing happened? They are fully adult in their ability to reason and think cognitively about risk. What they don't have yet is the emotional systems that keep them from acting on their evaluation of risk.
Leslie,
so for instance,
go ahead, Sam.
Oh, so a general principle is that the brain matures from back to front. And so this maturational process, which isn't complete until the 20s, tends to reach frontal parts of the brain last. And one participant in impulse control is the orbital frontal cortex, and it seems to orchestrate the connection between emotion and good judgment. So even though these kids can think about the problem cognitively, they don't have those connections fully online for holding back the impulse.
Now, we do see some disorders emerge with puberty, don't we? Maybe ADHD starts earlier, but we see kids becoming depressed, having bipolar disorder, sometimes more serious psychological conditions. Is that because of the changes in the brain?
Nobody knows why that is. It's one of the great mysteries of neuroscience, but you're right, there are a very large collection of mental illnesses that show up for the first time around puberty, including schizophrenia, some very serious illnesses.
A listener, Leslie, asks if you'll speak to the issue of teenagers' increased need for sleep. She says her 16-year-old daughter says she feels like a freak because she can easily sleep 10 to 11-hour nights over a weekend, but that her friends don't. She goes to bed before 10 so on school nights, but says her friends can stay up to midnight routinely. What are the facts? Don't kids need more sleep when they're going through changes, when their bodies are growing and their brains are going through changes as well?
Well, it's not necessarily the case that they need more sleep, but one thing that is interesting that happens during adolescence is that the natural waking up time and the natural going to sleep time seem to shift by about an hour. You can think of it as the brain being one time zone to the west, so it's sort of an adolescent savings time. And when people have measured brain sleep signals such as melatonin, after puberty, nocturnal melatonin levels — melatonin is a signal that helps trigger the onset of sleep — the melatonin levels at night decline sharply, and so it seems that maybe adolescents are getting smaller and later sleep signals. And this teenager we're talking about here, who needs to sleep more on weekends, that's a very common phenomenon, which is commonly called sleep debt, where people, adolescents in particular, are forced to get up at a certain time during the week because of school, and then have to make it up because they are at that point sleep deprived because they're an hour off from everybody else.
I can't remember any kid I grew up with who didn't stay in bed until past noon on weekends.
At least sleep debt.
Unless they had somewhere to go. We go now to Monica from Piscataway. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, go ahead, Monica.
I grew up in Bulgaria, which at the time was the height of communism, and there were absolutely no consumer goods. I immigrated in my 20s to the States, and appropriately became a nanny for three girls. Everything here is surprisingly so gender codified. And I was, for the first time in my life, confronted with people dressing their kids in all pink or all blue. It was, I'm wondering if the changes that you're talking about culturally, or are they, we're talking about purely about Western societies, because in Bulgaria, you were lucky if you found something, period. And I came here and babies, kids' rooms, everything was so, so codified.
Monica, can I ask you a question? When you're growing up in Bulgaria, did you think the boys and girls were acting exactly the same?
No. And surprisingly, one of my professors — I studied economics. My mother is a pediatric nurse in Bulgaria. And I am very much a tomboy still at 42. And he asked her if she was concerned when I was growing up, because I like playing with boy toys, if she was concerned that I might be a lesbian. And you can see it had never dawned on my mother. She was just stunned, and she just said, "I never thought about it."
Well, I'm not going to ask you how things worked out. That may be...
Still straight.
what about Monica's point that we stress these kinds of sex differences a lot more in Western cultures than they do in other parts of the world? Is that true?
It certainly matters a lot how your culture handles the sort of public manifestation of sex differences, in terms of how much you think about it, how it influences your interactions with the world on a day-to-day basis. One of the interesting points is that in Chinese, for instance, there's no separate pronoun for he and she. It's all the same word. And that's why you'll often hear people who grew up speaking Chinese call men she and women he in conversation. But one of the side effects of having gendered pronouns the way we do in English is that you can't even talk about a person without knowing what gender they are. And that creeps into the psychology in some really interesting ways.
Now, Sam, you mentioned earlier that the distance that the computer allows us has led to decrease in empathy among teenagers. What about the fact that kids like to spend a lot of time playing video games and watching television and using cell phones along with the internet? Do we know yet how these, what kind of impact that will have on the development of their brains?
Well, this is a process that's unfolding, and we're watching it in real time as these technologies develop, because they develop so much faster than biological evolution. So we have this genetic program that sets up our brains to survive really well in a particular world. That particular world is thousands of years in the past. And we've got this social learning machine that's our brains, and then it encounters a thing like text messaging or a video game or what have you. And what's certain is that brains are powerful learning machines. They learn to adapt to their environments. And so, for instance, it's been demonstrated that there are positive effects, like a shoot-em-up action video game will improve hand-eye coordination. Laparoscopic surgeons who obsessively play video games are better than those who do not. So there's a big practice effect. But obviously, there can be negative effects as well. And so there's this big natural experiment going on a billion-person scale in which we're learning what all these things do. Now, I should say that some things are positive. There's been a gradual increase over the last 100 years in IQ scores across many countries, and that's probably because of some environmental effect that we don't entirely understand, but it could partly be technological.
But as a result, laparoscopic surgeons also take great pleasure in imagining blowing up buildings, don't they? you point out
as long as they don't do it during the surgery.
You point out that teenagers, that social rejection reduces IQ. Can you explain how that works?
It works by essentially preoccupying your attention. So in order to do anything smart, you need to have your working memory available to you. It's like the brain's scratch pad as you're thinking about a hard problem. And social rejection eats up that resource. It leads you to not be able to concentrate properly on being able to solve a problem. So social rejection decreases people's ability to solve hard problems without affecting their ability to solve easy problems.
Rowena from Queens, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question in regards to... Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Sorry. I had a question in regards to the testing again of transgender students, but more along the lines of if students... I think that there's obviously testing evidence that girls and boys test differently, but what role do you think the socialization plays in that girls aren't led towards mathematics and the sciences, but rather are sort of stunted that way and not necessarily given a chance to flourish there? Do you think that affects it as well, not just the way our brains function?
Rowena's asking whether... the fact that some people are pushed into one kind of area or another of interest affects the way our brains develop. Is that still happening?
There's a phenomenon called stereotype threat, in which you are reminded of things that your ethnic group or your sex is good at or not good at. There's a great study that's been done in which Asian girls are given... are prompted with a question before a math test, and the question is either what's your gender or what's your ethnicity. And depending on the question, if they get asked the ethnicity question, then they do a little bit better because everybody knows that Asians are good at math. And but if they get asked their gender, well, they don't do quite so well. And so there is this small effect of what you think of your own abilities that you can prompt at the beginning of an exam.
And following that and the discussion of IQ, a listener asks, is the fact that learning requires so much attention another reason children who grew up in poverty are at a disadvantage when it comes to learning?
It is. It's even more complicated than that, actually, because remember I was talking a minute ago about working memory as the brain's scratch pad. And one of the things that growing up in poverty does is it puts you under chronic stress that directly impairs learning. And it also means that you're spending a lot of your brain power thinking about things like, how do I get to school safely, that don't contribute to your learning math or reading once you get there.
Let's try to sneak Mike in here. Mike from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey.
You have to make it quick, Mike. Hello, Mike. Well, that was quick. I think Mike's question was about the effects of drugs and alcohol on teens. I'm not sure where he wanted to go with it, but some kids wind up taking a lot of drugs and alcohol. Others are straight shooters. We have any idea of what impact that, well, why that happens and what impact that will have on their learning and the development of their brains?
Well, this goes with the other things we were talking about with other risks like mood disorders, schizophrenia, ADHD, all coming on at puberty. Remember, we talked about the approach to novel things. Certainly, drugs and alcohol can be novel things for a teenager. Certainly, they are lacking for relative to what they'll be 10 years later. They're lacking for impulse control. And so this is a time of susceptibility to drug and alcohol use. And probably the things we've talked about can account for a good deal of things like experimenting with drugs. This has been known since ancient Roman times, as it turns out.
And I want to thank the both of you, neuroscientists Sam Wong and Sandra Amat, who are the co-authors of Welcome to Your Child's Brain, How the Mind Grows from Conception to College, published by Bloomsbury, for giving us another really fascinating Please Explain segment. Thank you so much.
Thank you.